Roads. Tonight on Banfield, Donald Trump at the crossroads. Is this the beginning of his return to power or the end of his political career? The decision might not actually be up to him. Also tonight, where are all the party people? A former Democratic congresswoman sheds her party label, and millions of voters drop their blue and red banners too. Is the label of the future independent or indifferent? And then, the new face of Russia's war in Ukraine. His comrades call him General Armageddon. Imagine what his enemies and his victims call him. And later, does your daughter's school know things about her health that even you don't know? Things that could be used against her and your family. A routine form for student athletes becomes potential criminal evidence in a post-Roe America. And Kanye West goes where even Kanye West wasn't expected to.
Yes.
See the business meeting he held with executives and the adults-only presentation he forced them to watch. It is all straight ahead on Banfield. Hello and welcome. It is Tuesday. This is Banfield, and President Biden is making some big headlines tonight, and it is news that goes straight to your wallet. In an interview that just aired moments ago on CNN, the president tamped down all that rampant fear out there that we are headed over the cliff and into a recession. Instead, he says the R word, if it comes our way, won't be nearly the wallop that some would have you believe.
Should the American people prepare for a recession?
I don't think there will be a recession. If it is, it'll be a very slight recession. That is, we'll move down slightly. Well, look, think about what's happened. We have done more. We're in a better position than any other major country in the world, economically and politically. We still have real problems. But look what we got done. We passed so much legislation. It is possible. Look, it is possible. I don't anticipate it.
The president also talked about Brittany Griner, who's in prison in Russia, and the only subject that he would discuss with President Putin.
Well, if he came to me at the G20 and said, I want to talk about the release of Griner, I'd meet with him.
But while President Biden might be grabbing a lot of the headlines right this moment, it's his one-time opponent and maybe future opponent, Donald Trump, who's getting all the attention. He is in a virtual funnel cloud right now of speculation. Did his latest lawyer flip on him? Are Trump and his son, Eric, dodging a subpoena by evading a process server? Is the DOJ closer to indicting him? Does he still have more classified documents stashed away somewhere else? And here's the big one. Will he run for president again in 2024? And if so, what are his chances? It is a lot to take in, so let's go one by one, starting with that last question. Does Trump have another shot at the Oval Office? It has Democrats on edge and his potential Republican rivals stuck in neutral. For the record, Trump has not officially made an announcement, but he sure dropped a lot of hints. This summer, he told a crowd in Nevada this.
We had a president who ran twice and won twice and may have to do it a third time. Can you believe that?
And that, of course, was a reference to the false claim that the 2020 election was somehow stolen. It wasn't. Last month, he told a crowd in Pennsylvania this.
And in 2024, most importantly, I got to say, Ted, I'm sorry, but most importantly, I shouldn't say that, Ted, but most importantly, we're going to take back our magnificent White House. We're going to take it back.
The New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman, who is currently promoting her book about Trump, says most of Trump's own team does believe that he will run. And they also say, quote, the second he says he's not, he's irrelevant. So, what might a second Trump administration mean for this country? Well, the Washington Post magazine has done a really deep dive on that. They surveyed 21 experts in politics, the military, the economy, and civil rights. And their assessment was pretty grim. It ranges all the way from oligarchy to a police state and the collapse of the democracy. To be fair, the Washington Post has its critics. But all of this hinges on Trump even being allowed to run again. And the investigations around him and his family aren't going away. And tonight, there are serious questions about one of his most trusted lawyers who just sat down with the feds. If the name Christina Bobb sounds familiar, it should. She was the Trump attorney who signed that infamous letter back on June 3rd, swearing up and down that there were no more presidential records nor classified documents in Trump's possession at Mar-a-Lago. Well, look at that picture. That's the proof right there. The statement was untrue because 2 months later, the FBI found all that. It was more than 100 records with classification markings at Mar-a-Lago and thousands of other documents, including some documents like this that were even in Trump's own desk. So that letter, According to reports, Bob just met with the federal prosecutors on Friday, and she said that while she didn't sign that letter, she didn't write that letter, and then also said she didn't know whether it was true. Okay, so that's a lot of trouble for her, and who knows what she'll do about it. She pointed fingers at two other Trump lawyers, though, and that's also trouble, because those lawyers may or may not, at some point in the future, point fingers at Trump himself. And when I say lawyers, I mean all of them. That is happening in Florida, but there's also action in New York. Remember, that is where Trump and his kids are facing a massive lawsuit accusing them of financial crimes. By now, almost all of the lawsuit's 16 defendants have been served, all except for two. And those two, Donald Trump and Eric Trump, his son. New York Attorney General claims that Trump and Eric have been using, quote, gamesmanship to duck and run from the process server and thus further delay this lawsuit. There is a whole lot to discuss tonight. Unfortunately, I'm joined by two people who literally wrote the book on the Trump administration. It's called The Divider, Trump in the White House, 2017 to 2021. Very happy to welcome its author, Susan Glasser, a staff writer for The New Yorker, and Peter Baker, chief White House correspondent for The New York Times. Welcome to both of you. I'm so glad to have you on. This is a real privilege, especially tonight when we have some breaking news with the president, who is just giving an interview to Jake Tapper. I want you to, if you can, I'll start with you, Peter. The news that the president made tonight about the recession. Maybe it's not huge news, but anything that he mentions with recession in the sentence is a big deal because, as we all know, it's the economy, stupid, when it comes to elections. And we've got a midterm coming up in a couple of weeks. Is that sort of the main headline that will be out on the front of The New York Times? Or is this just white noise because people feel it? It doesn't matter what you say.
Well, you're right. Obviously, what people pay more attention to is what they see in their own lives, their own wallets, their own pocketbooks, their ability to get a job and so forth. But it is important for a president to frame expectations and frame the understanding of it. And that's something President Biden is trying to do 30 days out from an election. Now, look, if there is a recession, it's an odd one, right? We have had negative growth. That is a normal sign of recession. And obviously, we're seeing high inflation. At the same time, we have only 3.5% unemployment. We have a labor shortage. So in other words, if you want a job, you can pretty much get one, even if it might not be the one you want. So it's an odd situation that doesn't that defies the normal categorization. But you're right that it is a political question as much as an economic question at this point out.
So, Susan, talk to me about that one comment as well about what would compel the president to speak with President Putin. And I would have expected the answer to be the war. But instead, it was if Putin approaches me at the G7, I think it's in May, it's in the spring anyway, in Japan. If Putin approached him, he would discuss Brittany Griner with him. Were you surprised at that?
Well, look, I think the point that Biden was trying to make, which is an interesting one, is that you don't want to reward Putin's nuclear blackmail. And that's frankly what it is. Vladimir Putin has been blackmailing not only Ukraine, but the rest of the world with his very reckless talk about nuclear weapons and whether he might need to resort to them. Just the other day, Biden was reported to have talked about the possibility of Armageddon at a fundraiser, contemplating the consequences of Putin's, not doing well on the battlefield and essentially escalating by use of this. So I think the point that the U.S. has stressed from the beginning that Biden emphasized in this interview tonight was it's not for the United States to negotiate the fate of Ukraine. Putin wants to portray it as the United States versus Russia. But the reality is that Putin has invaded his neighbor, Ukraine. The United States is not a party to the war on the ground.
I was just so surprised that his answer wasn't right away. Yeah, I'd speak to him right away about what he's doing to schoolyards and clinics and these horrendous, you know, bombs dropping on civilians. But it was Brittany Griner. I'm sure the Griners are thrilled about that, and her wife as well. Let me ask you this, Peter. You're a reporter. You cover a lot of politics for the New York Times. I cover a lot of crime, politics. I'm all over the map. But when I do cover crime, I know a thing or two about it. And I know how prosecutors work. They oftentimes will look for a concentric circle and then squeeze their way to the top. And when I saw this news about Christina Bobb speaking to the Department of Justice, it's what I sort of thought right away. And that's where my mind went, that they could easily take a lawyer or a few and accuse them of a conspiracy that could land them 20 years and, you know, ditch the law license forever and say, talk. It's about time that you talked. And I wonder if you were struck like I was about the fact that Christina Bobb instantly spoke with the DOJ and pointed fingers at other lawyers, too.
Yeah, I think that's a very important development. You're absolutely right. And any normal investigation, particularly of this kind of stakes, you do work your way in, right? You don't start at the top. You work your way in through the people around the person you might be targeting, the person who's at the top. In this case, obviously, Christina Bobb has something to explain. That letter that she signed puts her right in the crosshairs of prosecutors who are obviously investigating, have said they're investigating obstruction of justice. If she gave an untruthful statement, they want to know, how was it untruthful? Did she make it? Did somebody tell her to make it? Who told her to make it? Was the president, former president, involved? That's a big question to ask. And if they're going to go after former President Trump on obstruction, they're going to want her testimony. It is surprising that she did it voluntarily, given how many lawyers have resisted over time whenever they've been seeking testimony against President Trump. It makes you wonder what she has to tell them and why she's going in. But she clearly feels some vulnerability herself and obviously would like to avoid, presumably, some sort of legal exposure that could put her in the crosshairs.
Yeah, all I can think is that, you know, ever since that fateful day when she signed her name to the DOJ officials who were right there, she didn't think it was as big a deal as it was. And then all of a sudden, she knows how big a deal it really is. However, a lawyer, I'm sorry, should always know. I know when I sign a document. I didn't write it. If I sign it, I better attest to it. So let me ask you this, Susan. The Washington Post's deep dive into a future Trump presidency. You know, there are a lot of people out there who they're very independent in the way they think. They don't maybe watch MSNBC or Fox News, you know, religiously. They really sort of have an open mind and they wonder, well, is this just one of those hit jobs? You know, papers are even accused of being left wing and right wing. This is the Washington Post. It's not the Wall Street Journal. The report may not be the same. If the Wall Street Journal did the same deep dive, those experts that were interviewed might not be the same as well. But you've written your book on the Trump presidency, and I'd love to get your take on that body of work, assessing that you know, a 2024 Trump presidency would be apocalyptic.
You know, we did do the divider in part because we wanted to study not just the catastrophic ending of the Trump presidency with its lies about the 2020 election, but to show how it built up to it and that it wasn't really an outlier, but in many ways a logical consequence of Trump's four-year assault on American institutions. And one of the strong takeaways that we came away with from doing the book, talking with more than 300 sources just after the Trump presidency in original reporting, in addition to pulling together a voluminous amount of work that was done during Trump's presidency, it's very clear that over time he shed advisors who he perceived as constraining him, that he became even more disruptive in his attacks on institutions as he gained confidence in the presidency, that he made personal loyalty increasingly rather than ideology or anything else the litmus test. And there are many of those who worked with Trump. These are, you know, Republicans who Trump himself appointed, who came away believing that he would be even more reckless and dangerous in a second term than he was in the first. So that's very consistent with, I think, what some of the expert predictions are. We spoke with one senior national security official who spent a lot of time with Trump in the Oval Office, who told us they believed that Trump was like the Velociraptor in the first Jurassic Park movie. Remember when the children are chased into the kitchen and click, the door handle turns and they realize that the Velociraptor has learned to open the door. And I think that was the perception of some of those who observed Trump very closely, that he had learned to use the levers of power and in service of disruptive goals that he might not have attained in the first term.
That's fascinating. What an analogy, too. It's great for people who aren't Gen Z, because they didn't see that movie necessarily. So, Peter, this is a question I think, I was just watching Dwayne The Rock Johnson also being asked whether he would consider a run for the presidency. And I'm laughing only because, you know, is that really where it's at these days, that you just got to have a big, shiny candidate, a populist now? And would the Democrats ever consider at this point that's what they have to do? They got to take a page from the Republican playbook, because Trump didn't have any political experience and Dwayne The Rock Johnson doesn't. They're both, you know, really exciting, exuberant and enjoyable characters. And Dwayne didn't put it out of the zeitgeist, but he said not now. But it is a question. Is that what the Democrats have to do now in order to keep the White House? Because even Democrats are turning on President Biden with all the videotape and the criticisms that he's had, maybe not for his policy, but maybe for his person.
Yeah, no, the Democrats are in an interesting position right now, right? You're right about them not necessarily wanting President Biden to run again. Most of the Democrats support President Biden if you look at the polls, but they think that maybe one term would be enough for him and they want somebody else to show up in 2024. That puts the Democrats in an awkward position because the president may run again. He says he is, and it's very possible, particularly if Trump runs again, that he'll be motivated to do that. But you're right, the celebrity has entered politics in a way that we hadn't seen in our earlier lifetime, right? That people talked about not just Dwayne The Rock Johnson, but people like Oprah Winfrey, and what about Mark Cuban? What about, you know, this person or that person who's very famous without any political experience? And of course, until 2016, we used to laugh that off because it was unthinkable. President Trump obviously proved that it's not impossible for somebody without experience to come into office. But I don't think that means the Democrats are necessarily going to turn that way. That hasn't been the way they approached 2020. And I'm not sure at this point there's any room, obvious there anyway for a candidate in 2024 like that. But you can't make predictions in politics. We'll have to wait, first of all, to see whether the incumbent president decides to run again.
It's just great talking to you guys. Thank you so much, Peter Baker and Susan Glasser. The book is called The Divider, Trump in the White House, 2017 to 2021. I look forward to the next chance that we can get together and do this again.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. All right, still to come, we now know, we're divided. Blue states and red states, Dems and Republicans, and no middle ground to be found, right? Wrong. After a break. The political movement neither party wants to talk about, because it's no party at all, but it's big and it matters, and you very well might be part of it.
The countdown is on, with the critical midterms just weeks away, and News Nation is bringing you the debates which will affect the balance of power Friday.
Welcome back. When is a Republican not a Republican? When he or she decides the party no longer speaks to his or her interests or beliefs. And the very same thing goes for the Democrats. Even Democrats who served in high elected office and aspired to the highest office of all. Democrats like this one, Tulsi Gabbard. Today, the former congresswoman from Hawaii announced that she is bolting the Democratic Party, which she pretty much declared war on after losing the Democratic presidential nomination back in 2020. She endorsed Joe Biden, but then she turned on him. And she turned up as a Fox News contributor and sometimes fill-in for Tucker Carlson. But while her story may be unique, her path most definitely is not. Millions of voters have shed their party labels to the point that independents, the neither nor camp, are this country's biggest voting bloc of all. So welcome. Nice to have you. News Nation senior national correspondent Brian Enten joins me now with his new reporting on all of this. And Brian, I've been watching a lot of these polls, like, you know, trying to count the independents among us. And some of them have, you know, the independent bloc as high as 60% of all the voters out there. What have you been finding?
Yeah, it's definitely growing. And it's interesting, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats get so much attention, but you mentioned it. I mean, there are so many independents out there. I think I've had the best assignment with our political coverage over the last couple months, because my job has been mainly to go out to the battleground states and to talk to real people, real voters, not the politicians. And the thing that I keep hearing over and over again from people is that they don't like Republicans, and they also don't like Democrats. And maybe they agree with a few things on the Democratic side and the Republican side, but at the end of the day, they view themselves as independents.
If you can no longer stomach the direction that the so-called woke Democratic Party ideologues are taking our country, I invite you to join me.
Former Congresswoman and 2020 presidential candidate Tulsi Gabbard officially says she is leaving the Democratic Party.
I believe in a government that's of the people, by the people, and for the people. Unfortunately, today's Democratic Party does not. Instead, it stands for a government that is of, by, and for the powerful elite.
Dropping parties, changing parties, frustrated by parties. We've traveled the country talking to voters in battleground states, and it seems to be a common theme.
You were a Democrat.
Yes.
And what changed?
A lot changed.
Like Gabbard, Lydia Dominguez in Nevada told us she is now turned off by the Democrats racializing every issue.
We're all Americans. We should consider ourselves Americans. We're not, you know, a white, black, brown. We're Americans. We should be united in that front. That's what makes us different from the world.
In Arizona, we met Yvonne Drew, who also said she is no longer Democrat, but also doesn't identify fully with Republicans.
I think that more people need to educate themselves, and I think that you have to watch a little bit of everything and kind of just watch who takes action and what actions are being taken by our current administration. Because they say a lot of things on TV and you go, wait a minute, that's not true, because you know, that doesn't add up. That doesn't make sense. I know what I see.
According to a recent Gallup poll, 30% of Americans consider themselves Republican. 24% say they identify as Democrat, and 43% are independent. Compare that to about 2 years earlier, and the Republican numbers stay the same, but there were more Democrats and fewer independents. More Americans seem to not trust either side.
The government lies to us all the time. Ever since I was a kid, I knew the government lied. And I always knew that if I were ever to vote, I had to vote for the best liar. The one who sold me the bill of goods. Right? So that's what it comes down to.
And what he said there really does seem to be a common theme among people, that they just don't trust politicians in general. And in many ways, you really can't blame them, Ashley.
So a big question I have is are a lot of people you're talking to dumping out of their party, either Democratic or Republican Party, because of issues and platform issues and positions on issues, or integrity, the fact that they just don't like these people?
I think it's both. I think they definitely don't like the people, but the issues, especially this go around, seem to be a big deal. For example, in Pennsylvania, we met a number of women who have always been Republicans, but because of the abortion issue, they say this time, for the first time ever, they will vote Democrat. I met a number of people in Nevada, very, very passionate about immigration and the border, said they always identified as Democrat, but because of what they see happening at the border, for the first time ever, they'll vote as Republican. So the issues really, really do come into play in the end.
And are people telling you from both parties, when they're abandoning ship, are they telling you where they're leaning in these midterms?
It just depends. Again, different parts of the country, different things. Here in Florida, it's been fascinating. There are people who told me that they've always been Democrats. They didn't like the COVID shutdown, so they moved to Florida. They still don't really feel like Republicans, but for the first time ever, they may vote Republican this go around. I think that's what's going to be so exciting and interesting about this midterm election, is there are all these variables that haven't really come into play before. And I think that's why we're covering it so closely. No one really knows how this is going to play out.
It's a nail biter. Brian Enten, thank you. Appreciate your work there in Florida. You know, it is not just the Democrats who are seeing defectors. It happens on the right side of the aisle as well. And I'm joined now by Tara Settmeyer, the senior advisor for the Lincoln Project and the resident scholar at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Also a friend. Hi, Tara. Good to have you. Question for out of the gate. When we talk about defectors, they do come from both parties. I think about Adam Kinzinger, who just in the last little while has been like, you know, a Republican congressman who's been endorsing Democratic candidates and is kind of just fed up with it all. So give me your take on defections. Is it different all of a sudden right now, or have we kind of always been like this?
Well, I get it. Since I was one of those defectors, I left the Republican Party in 2020 after the election, after 27 years of working in Republican politics and on conservative policies and working on Capitol Hill. So I understand. And for me, the inflection point was finally realizing that the Republicans were no longer going to stand up to Donald Trump, even if he went against the Constitution by denying the election and denying a peaceful transfer of power. We saw what happened on January 6th. So I think that I, you know, me joining the ranks of the 43%, according to Gallup, of independents now in this country is just something that I've realized that more and more people have become frustrated with both parties because they feel politically homeless, because they feel as though they're not being spoken to. Now, I mean, on the Democratic side, they may have issues with the progressive left. On the Republican side, clearly, we see that there are a lot of people who have issues with the way that the party has succumbed to Donald Trump and to the election denying and the extremism that's coming out of the right, that they can no longer identify with the party. I mean, I don't know that Adam has denounced the party yet, but Congressman Denver Riggleman is one who's left the party. And there were other prominent Republicans who left the GOP because they couldn't stomach the direction it's going in, becoming such an anti-democratic party. So the two-party system, I don't think we've seen as much dissatisfaction with our two-party system as we see now. But what concerns me is the problem is the lack of the lack of confidence in our election integrity and in confidence in our governing. To me, that is very problematic for the future of our democracy.
Yeah, that's pretty upsetting stuff. That's what our foundation is, you know, is all that and a bag of chips. I want to, to that point that you just said, that it's never been worse than now, I want to throw up a list of defectors in the past. And this is really just the recent past. I could go all the way back to the 70s and there's a whole bunch more. But, you know, here's a list of senators. I'm not sure if we can get it, but I'm going to work on it. But, you know, out of the senators, Strom Thurmond, Harry Byrd, Richard Shelby, Jim Jeffords, Joe Lieberman, Arlen Specter, all switching parties, some one to the other, some Republican to Dem, some Dem to Republican, some into the Independent Party. And in Congress, Phil Gramm, Nathan Deal, Michael Forbes as well. Here's the question when it comes to these guys. They switch and they find their home. But for all of us out here, if we're sick of our party and we don't like the other party, now what do we do? It turns out there's like a massive majority out here that Dan Abrams calls the marginalized majority. And I sort of think, well, why hasn't anybody thought up and funded party number three?
Well, we've seen that there have been efforts to form third parties and they have failed miserably over the years just because of the way our election system is set up. It is
funding,
set up to
funding.
Money, right? Money is a big issue, but part of the reason why is because our voting system is decentralized. So you have to be able to fund the efforts in 50 states because 50 states have 50 different ways of voting. You have some states that have open primaries, some states that don't. You have some states that have different, supervisors of elections that are elected, some are appointed. I mean, there's a lot, and the founders didn't want a centralized voting system. They also didn't want factions either. So it was a little bit of a mixed bag what we ended up with. But that's part of the reason why it's been so difficult for a third party to emerge in this country, because the way it's structurally rigged against that. And I think more people are becoming frustrated by it, but they're looking to make inroads there because there are so many folks that are now joining the politically homeless like myself. But we'll see. It will have to start, but at a state-by-state level if they're going to make inroads with that. But right now, this is the system that we have. And I think one of the first most realistic places to start is to get rid of closed primaries. That's how you get the extremists.
Yeah, I agree with that.
We see the extremists going, you know, what happens when we get that across the country with all these election deniers running across, you know, in various states and localities. And that's very dangerous.
I got to wrap it there, but I want to have you back for a whole conversation about a two-party ticket, because that's another option, right? Let's talk about that another time. Tara Settmeyer, good to see you. Thanks.
Thank you, Ashley.
Coming up next, they call him General Armageddon for a reason. And what a surprise. He's now in charge of the killing in Ukraine. Find out the sick and twisted things he's done before and how this war just hit American airports. Stay with us. If your nickname is General Armageddon, you might think you'd be Vladimir Putin's first choice to lead Russian troops in Ukraine. And for whatever reason, he wasn't. But he is now. He's in charge and he's already making his mark, which is scorched earth and bloodbaths in places like playgrounds and clinics and schools. His real name is Sergei Surovikin, and he was named a hero of Russia for decimating the city of Aleppo in Syria back in 2016. Take a look at that. I'll just remind you that this was Syria in 2016. That's five-year-old Omran Dakhnish, who we all saw in the back of an ambulance like that. And that was a normal picture back then. Back to General Armageddon. That was his handiwork. That guy has since been to jail, actually, two times. Once after soldiers under his command murdered three demonstrators before the fall of the Soviet Union, and later for dealing in black market weapons. In two short days on the job, he has again brought the war in Ukraine dangerously close to NATO territory, with missiles hitting 40 miles from Poland. And also in Russia, the oligarchs are making waves again. Yuri Milner, a billionaire known as the richest Russian in Silicon Valley, just announced he is renouncing his Russian citizenship. Alexei Mordashov, meanwhile, who's a steel tycoon with one of the world's biggest super yachts, that guy is seeking safe haven for that mega yacht in Hong Kong. It's a cat and mouse game against Western sanctions. You'll remember we've covered this at length. And Hong Kong, under Beijing's control, will not enforce the sanctions and seize those beautiful yachts. Safe harbor for Putin's friends and their mega toys. And now U.S. airports are caught in the fray. I'm not sure if you heard this, but pro-Russian hackers who go by the name Killnet took out a number of major airport websites yesterday, including LAX, Chicago O'Hare, and Hartsfield-Jackson in Atlanta. Doesn't seem like any airline traffic was affected, but yikes. And then there is Iran. Protests against the Ayatollah and his mullahs have now led to a major protest strike at a key oil refinery in that country. Of course, Iran's state media says, nothing to see here, didn't happen, everybody head home, all is fine. They're also denying that the government killed that 16-year-old protester named Nika Shakarami, seen here breaking every government rule by just being a cute teenage girl. Nika is also seen here in some new video, burning her headscarf in protest. And that was just a couple of hours before she was killed. You know, the death that the government says it didn't cause? Instead, the government claims that she was thrown from a building by random construction workers. And they point to this grainy footage as proof. But Nika's family says that grainy footage that shows a person is a person who is not even Nika, and that the government of Iran is lying. Still ahead tonight, if you have a daughter in a school sport, did you know that they know personal stuff about her that even you don't know? And did you know that information can one day be used against your family in court? Stories next. Welcome back. If you are a high school student in Florida or pretty much anywhere else and you want to play sports, you have to fill out a medical history form. Do you have asthma, allergies? Do you have seizures? It's that sort of stuff. But if you're a girl, the form has a few more questions, at least in Florida. And five of those questions, many girls don't even tell their parents about. Details like their menstrual cycle. The questions are optional, and they have been routine for about two decades. But today, two things are different. One, Roe v. Wade was overturned, and some states are looking to classify abortion as murder. And two, many Florida schools are moving from paper forms to digital, and they've partnered with a new company called Activate. Activate is a public company, so Activate has to comply with subpoenas. You see where I'm going here? Activate legally can share your daughter's menstrual cycle with anybody, anyone, like the police, who might be nosing around about, say, an illegal abortion. Those police can subpoena your daughter's menstrual cycle. Talk about a violation of privacy. Talk about damning evidence. I want to bring in Dr. Chris Koutouris. He is the pediatrician who served on the committee that crafted that questionnaire. He's a sports medicine specialist from Active Kid MD Pediatrics. Also with us is healthcare attorney Harry Nelson. He's the author of From Obamacare to Trump Care, Why You Should Care. Dr. Koutouris, let me ask you off the bat. You helped to craft that questionnaire. And I think one of the first questions many of us who hear the story for the first time has is, why does anybody need to have the menstrual cycle information of a teenage girl?
That's a great question. The reason we ask is, if a young athlete's having regular periods, it means she's getting appropriate energy. It means that her ovaries are releasing a hormone called estrogen that helps keep bone health. So there aren't many girls who are going to come into my office and say, you know what, I'm worried about not getting enough energy. I'm worried about possibly having weak bones. But if we work backwards and we ask them about their menstrual history, we find out if they're not having regular periods, they might be at higher risk for bone stress injuries, anorexia, bulimia, conditions that could be life-threatening.
But, you know, I don't have girls, but I have boys, and I have to take them to the doctor every year. And these seem to be perfect questions for doctors who should ask those questions, get that information, and then advise parents, hey, watch it about school. I don't like what I'm seeing here. And I'm just so sort of bemused by the fact that nobody thought that before they thought, let's ask the schools to ask that question. But yet they did.
Well, first of all, we need to explain. We need to do a better job in the medical field of explaining why we ask the questions. The second thing is, most schools want to know one or two things, clear or not. That's what coaches want to know. So reality is, as long as the school gets the form saying yay or nay, red light, green light, that's the most important thing. The medical history stays between the provider, the family, the child, and whoever they wish to share it with. But we don't need to necessarily worry about that. It's, are you cleared or not? That's the main question most athletes want to hear about and what most coaches and administrators want to hear about.
Okay, cue the lawyer. All right, Harry Nelson, this is where my spidey senses start going bananas. If the state of Florida is going to contract out the storage of these digital files to a company, a public company called Activate, they're subpoenaable. And if they're, I mean, it's so easy to connect this line, right? That if a young girl decides to get an abortion, an illegal abortion in this new world, that could be evidence used against her, and her family would have to face that music in court. Something they thought would help her bone health is now maybe going to see her put away for murder at age 17.
Yeah, it's actually, you're pointing to a really important point that people need to understand, which is that when you input information like menstrual history into these general websites that are not healthcare providers, they are not subject to any consumer privacy or HIPAA or other medical privacy laws. There needs to be much better state and federal protection of general consumer privacy for this kind of data. Because as you described, we've already had cases where law enforcement went online and got data online to pinpoint that there had been an illegal termination of a pregnancy. So this is really already happening.
And this just might be Florida, but look, this is a new world we're living in post-Roe. So it's not whether you're pro-abortion or anti-abortion. This is about your kids. And sometimes kids, you know, do things unbeknownst to parents. And they can sometimes skirt the law, and parents will have no idea. So, Dr. Koutouris, I wanted to ask you what your thought was when you learned that the documents that you had helped to draw up were actually, you know, being contracted out to an outside storage facility. I say that because digital is a facility, and the outside right. storage facility is not under the protections of HIPAA and privacy.
Well, it made me realize we're living in a whole different world than we put these forms together just a few years ago. And I have the same fears about privacy. I have the same fears about the confidential nature of the discussion we have in the exam room. And is that information going to be shared in a way that could be detrimental to the health of both the athlete and his or her family? That's a problem. So I do have my concerns that these pieces of information are being shared in a way that's not in the best interest of the young athlete and her family.
So to that end, Harry Nelson, if, let's just say, something went awry, you had no idea that your 17 or 18-year-old daughter got pregnant, sought an abortion without you knowing, this happens, people, would you have any idea as the parent that the police are subpoenaing an outside company called Activate for her menstrual records. Would the parent have any right to know that?
You know, it's an interesting question. If the girl in question is a minor, it's certainly possible that her parents might find out about it. But there's no guarantee about exactly how the request would come. But more importantly, there's also no end to where this information could end up, because what we see is that a lot of these companies that are storing information, again, that are not healthcare providers, are reselling that data. So all of a sudden, your daughter's information, her menstrual history, might be in the hands of all kinds of databases. We saw recently that the federal government, the Federal Trade Commission, cracked down on one of these data brokers. So the bigger problem is that the information is in lots of places that wouldn't even require a subpoena that a parent might see. I mean, once the information is out there on any kind of a website, including companies like Activate, there's no end to where it could end up and where government agencies could go and poke around to find it and send subpoenas. So there's,
well, yeah,
there's
really clear. I should be clear, though, that Activate has said that it does not sell any of this data at all. But again, I think the big critical issue here is that they are subject to subpoena, and public institutions, you know, like the government is not, you know, has to protect the privacy, the medical privacy through HIPAA. You know, you couldn't subpoena the school for that kind of information. But wow, what a whole new head scratcher this is going to create. Thank you, Chris Coutures. I appreciate it. And Harry Nelson, really appreciate your wisdom on this.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Got a little bit of breaking news to bring your way about some leaked clips from the Tucker Carlson interview with Kanye West. These are the clips that didn't air, but apparently he was heard on tape saying that fake children were planted in his home to influence his four children. Planned Parenthood was created to control the Jew populations. And I prefer my kids' new Hanukkah than Kwanzaa. At least it will come with some financial engineering. This is a big problem for Kanye. And here's something else. If he's in your business meeting, nobody's going to expect slides and bullet points. But the guys at Adidas weren't expecting full-on hardcore porn either, which is what Kanye, as he now likes to be called, Ye, showed them up close at length on his phone the other day in a meeting, apparently to air his grievances over some business deal. You watch the whole thing on YouTube, but the bigger point here is that the shoe guys were absolutely floored, and they were already on edge about his White Lives Matter flap in Paris last week, and then his online rant against Jews. So more Kanye news keeps coming out.